Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, should fake reviews and subscription traps be made illegal? The government's outlined plans to beef up consumer protections. But what does Simon and Lee make of them? We take a look at the high earners with insufficient savings and what you can do if this is you. We have some better news for savers though, but don't get too excited. Also, are you paying too much for your data? Probably. And don't fancy trying your luck holidaying abroad this year? What about a home swap instead? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the government is planning a major crackdown on subscription traps and fake reviews. Under the proposals, it will become illegal to pay someone to write or host bogus online ratings. Businesses offering subscriptions as well will also have to make it very clear exactly what people are signing up for and make it just as easy to cancel as it is to sign up in the first place. Lee, these are the two big plans from the government that have perhaps got the most headlines, but there are other measures in there as well. I see something about Christmas savings. So what is in there? But I guess more importantly, why do we have this?
The government is saying this is going to help boost competition and basically try and end consumer rip-offs. And there are quite a lot of these things that kind of happen. It's quite a mixed bag in this consultation. So it's in a consultation phase at the moment. So as you say there about fake reviews, a lot of us these days, I think I would say the vast majority, do overanalyze reviews on all sorts of things that we buy, whether that is going to a hotel, whether that is buying a new electric toothbrush on Amazon or something like that. And we get suckered into this hole of reading a load of reviews. But there is always that kind of threat that some of the reviews aren't legit. I watched a documentary once about a review farm out in India, where basically you can pay someone to go and leave a load of fake reviews on a product or on a service. And it can help manipulate consumer behavior. It can help people make that kind of leap and buy it on the strength of reviews. And we've become very used to that. I remember a long time ago speaking to the founder of TripAdvisor and asking him how he was stamping down on reviews. And a lot of these big websites and big companies have all sorts of algorithms and all sorts of ways of stopping this from happening, but it's still happening. So the government is saying stamping down on that and dishing out big fines if a company or a product or a service is found to be doing that. It's quite hard to police, though. I think it's very hard to sort of crack down completely on that. We've done investigations in the past, also in some of the big review websites that companies can pay for to be featured on, and again, sometimes delete some of the negative reviews and all of that kind of thing. And it manipulates consumer behavior. So that's one of the things that the government is talking about in there.
Before you jump on off from reviews, because I find this quite fascinating, I thought it was illegal anyway. I thought you must not write reviews for yourself. You must not write reviews of businesses you're familiar with. You must not employ people for that to write fake reviews. It is illegal, is it not?
Forgive me, I don't know the full law.
I think it falls under the Unfair Trading Regulations 2000 and something or other.
Again, but how many people have been caught out? How many businesses and companies have been caught out and fined or you know, prosecutions being brought forward for that? I think what they're trying to do here is beef it up a bit more.
What's so wrong with it? I mean, I use reviews all the time. I mean,
we're a generation that's got very used to reading reviews before we book everything. And some people are more into it than others. For example, my wife will literally trawl through hundreds of reviews about a hotel before booking.
And I'm the same, Liam.
Yeah, and I get it, and I do get it. And then sometimes you read some of the negative reviews and it's like, oh, that wouldn't really bother us or whatnot. And, you know, we shape our behaviour behind it. But it's if there's, unscrupulous companies or people that are having paid fake reviews put on certain websites or services and whatever, that gives that consumer confidence to go and click and actually it turns out not to be what you expected. Or it's just been completely manipulated into you buying it, and it's not good. You know, people waste money and might end up with something that they didn't want, or it's not been a service that they expected, because all of these reviews have been shaped. And we've done this before. We looked at, I won't mention the companies involved here, but there was one company that you wouldn't expect had something like 4.5 out of 5 stars, and then there was another company that had like 1.5 out of 5 stars, hundreds of reviews. And it was two brands that you would have thought it'd be the other way around. Mm. And it just turned out that one of the companies was paying the company in question, this review company, to have some of the negative reviews taken away. I'm not saying that they were paying for positive reviews, but that's what was happening. And then the other company wasn't paying for the service and it just was being unfiltered. And people are way more likely to complain than they are to leave a kind of 5-star review. True. And I've seen it in the past where you can get discounts or you're heavily encouraged to leave a review in order to get a discount because it keeps boosting, you know, this is what the kind of world we live in now. But as I always say to my wife about hotels, hotels already have a star system. You have a 5-star hotel, a 4-star hotel, a 3-star hotel, a 2-star hotel. That's been around for a very long time. I kind of know in general ballpark how nice a place it's going to be. And actually only this week, we have this constant like battle of finding something to watch on television. You know what it's like. And you can end up reading all these reviews and going on like, you know, the famous IMDb, you know, out of 10, and you only watch one over a set of film. Last week I was on holiday. I literally went on BBC iPlayer, fancy watching a film. I didn't do any of the review stuff. I just clicked on it, liked the sound of the premise, and it was fantastic. And I thought, I should just do that more often. Stop getting completely overwhelmed by
what
reviews.
Are you going to lose, Lee? A couple of hours of your life? Watching a bad movie. It's not like you're gonna lose a load of hundreds of pounds and get some really shoddy product. And
oh, exactly. So I guess the thing is there is some consumer responsibility here, because I think that quite often that you can trawl through these reviews and realize which ones are a bit sort of like copy and paste or a bit kind of false. But it depends how much weight you put behind it and how much weight you put behind reviews. And as I say, a lot of major websites, a lot of ones that people will shop on, will have algorithms, will have review teams, will have, you know, monitoring where IP addresses are coming. Is it a verified purchase? All of that kind of stuff already. I applaud the government for doing anything that will help crack down on any consumer ripoffs, but I kind of feel like there's already quite a lot in place doing that anyway.
Yeah. Apparently it's about £23 billion worth of stuff that we buy is influenced by reading reviews. So this is a huge, huge issue. And I feel sorry, I spoke to quite a few, especially small businesses starting up. These reviews are fundamentally important. And it is quite difficult to work out what are genuine and not. What I like to do is just look down, find the really low ratings. If it's a really rubbish reason, you think, okay, it could have just been a bad day, and the company have written back, then I think, okay, I can comfortably get rid of that. Simon?
My personal favourite type of review is when someone says that, basically gives a review where they've given 1 star, and then you read what they've written, and they've actually written about what great time they had and how wonderful a place was, and then there was one thing they did that upset them, and so they 1-star them. Or the vice versa, when someone has clearly had a terrible experience and has listed out all of the things that went wrong and then still gives someone like 3.5 or 4 stars just because they're too nice. I think most people can work it out. I think most people's radar for the really obvious stuff, the people with an axe to grind or the ones that are obviously fake, you know, because they're way too effusive. I think they can work that out. And there's a pattern, isn't there? You can tell the kind of fake, you know, effusive, this is really great ones, because they're all a bit similar. They're not that sophisticated, but some of this stuff is really sophisticated and you're not spotting those ones. You're not spotting the review farm stuff that's really good at it. And it is hugely important. I mean, it can make or break a business. That's why people ask you to review them on TripAdvisor. That's why people ask you to, companies email you saying, can you review this? Can you review that? And I think it is hugely useful. I mean, we've talked about this before, and I personally have bought stuff when I've been looking for various things based on the review as to whether it's any good. And often it'll be quite niche stuff, or maybe big item stuff. I certainly used it heavily when we were buying some garden furniture this year. I was one of the few people who actually managed to get a garden furniture set before the rush set in and there was none left. But I'd not heard of this company before. And so I was quite dubious about what the quality was going to be like. And I double checked, you know, sending it back and all that kind of stuff. But then I read some reviews and I did spend some time properly going through trying to work out, are these people saying this is good, genuinely reviewing it? Is this genuinely good? And actually, it turned out they were, and I've been very impressed with the quality and the price. And likewise, a couple of like more niche things, stuff like a jump pack for my car, which has an electrical drain on it that I can't track down. So if you don't drive it for about 2 weeks, you have to jump it. And I don't want to stop jump starting it from our other car because that's not really great for either of them. And it's not that convenient either because you can't just drive around in two cars all the time. The joy of having old cars, hey. And I've been really impressed with that. But I think one of the things that we should try to remember to do, I guess, is actually leave reviews ourselves, because the more useful reviews are, is if more normal people, and I'm sort of saying that we might be normal people here, I'm not sure we are, leave those reviews.
Great.
So it's kind of a community effort, isn't it? And that's what a lot of these things came out of, funnily enough, what are now huge businesses in some cases, came out of community efforts. And actually, if you do go somewhere and you do think it's good, then do bother to go leave them a review. Yeah. The problem is that when you do that, you end up and you sign up to, say, you sign up to TripAdvisor or you sign up to, I don't know, Trustpilot or whatever, something like that. You feel like you just end up getting spammed by the review service themselves afterwards. You're not just getting spammed by people trying to resell you things or places you've been. You're getting spammed by the review service as well. But if you speak to certainly people who do holiday lets, restaurants, hotels, small hotels and things like that, they will tell you how fundamentally important this kind of stuff is for them, because the first thing that people will do is they'll go and look stuff up online, and then they make a decision to go there. And people do it walking around the streets. I remember a couple of years ago, we were on holiday with my brother and sister-in-law as well, so two families, and we were in the south of France, and we were in a town called La Vendue, and we were looking for somewhere for dinner. And you know, when you just wander around, you don't really know where to go. It's like, oh, that looks all right kind of thing. We went to this restaurant. It was literally the worst restaurant experience I've ever had in my life. It was comedy bad. The service, the food, everything was just really rubbish. We came away from it going, that was absolutely terrible, but laughing about it. It was so bad. If we had bothered to Google it, we would have found TripAdvisor reviews for it. It wasn't a particularly big restaurant, it was just down Side Street. You wouldn't have necessarily thought that there would be TripAdvisor reviews for it. And it would have alerted us to the fact that this was not the kind of place we wanted to dine on our last evening on holiday. But it's amazing, actually, when you go to places like that, the amount of people you do see wandering around with their phone out, look at the menu, and then they Google it and check the TripAdvisor reviews. So it goes to show why it's so important for businesses, but also why it's such big business doing this stuff. And just to go back to something Lee said about reviews, we've looked into these before, and obviously the company leading the way on this stuff, certainly in the UK, is Trustpilot. Now, Trustpilot has different levels of, you know, service. There's the free service where anybody can leave a review about your business, and you can claim the page. And then there's the paid for service where you can have a bit more influence over what goes on. You're not allowed to go in and delete negative reviews and stuff like that, they say. And this story is going back, bear in mind, this story is going back to 2019. Things might change. But at the time, Trustpilot said paying for its service does not enable companies to improve their reviews, delete negative feedback, or get any unfair edge. However, a spokesman did say that the reason why there can be variations in scores is because subscribers might be actively encouraging all shoppers to leave reviews. So the companies that have bothered to pay, you know, Trustpilot, and bear in mind, you know, Trustpilot standard plan is £199 per month, so it's quite a lot of money. We'll actually be actively going out there and encouraging people to leave reviews, whereas companies that maybe don't subscribe are just getting the unhappy people, because you're far more likely to if you're really unhappy, you're far more likely to go online and complain about it than if you are just gently satisfied, or even really, really happy, to be honest. And that's, I think, something that people need to remember when they're looking at this stuff. So, and I mean, just looking at the Trustpilot page now on its plans, free plan, £0, engage with customers and show ratings. You claim your profile page, invite customer reviews, receive support, see basic performance reports, use two Trustbox widgets, and drive Google seller ratings. And then with the paid for plan, £199 a month, upgrade your profile page, invite more customer reviews, access to customer success team, learn from detailed analysis, use 8 review Trustbox widgets, drive Google seller ratings, gain access to marketing assets, customize with paid add-ons. customized with paid add-ons is a key thing there, is that, you know, you can pay a lot more than that £199 a month, because you can start adding things on and adding things on and adding things on. And, you know, big businesses pay a lot of money for this stuff.
Indeed they do. Just remember that reviews are other people's opinions, particularly when it comes to things like restaurants and hotels and those sorts of things. And, you know, I was just thinking when you were talking there, when I was in Mainz years ago before the pandemic, watching football, actually it was only last year, I went to the most hilarious German restaurant, and I was just looking at reviews on it now, and we've got things like impolite service and crap food, dark, drab and dreary, oh dear. I had a marvellous time. I mean, it was weird, I'm not going to lie, but it was an experience nonetheless. So, you know, take it with a pinch of salt.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, reading between the lines, actually, with reviews is quite amusing, because you can kind of work out sometimes whether that person is either like you or completely different to you. And if they're completely different to you, the kind of place that they don't like might be right up your street.
Exactly. Lee, we were in the middle as well, weren't we, of talking about some of the other measures that were coming in. A really annoying one, subscriptions. Just explain what's going on here.
Yeah, so they're talking about making it easier to cancel as it is to sign up for subscriptions, and that we're in a sort of subscription society now. I think over the last few years, the amount of monthly subscriptions that we go for has just, you know, ballooned, depending on what your interests are. I think, again, not sticking up for businesses and companies here, there's definitely been some strides to improve this area in the last few years as well. But that's not to say, again, that it's easy to cancel, you know, depending on the size of the business, depending on who they are. I tend to find it easy to cancel subscriptions. I've never really run into much of a problem. But again, any moves in that area to make it easier for people to cancel is fine by me. And it's a good one. And people do forget about them. I think that's more, again, there is some onus on a consumer here for me. Like, you should be knowing what's coming out of your account. And if you're thinking, oh, you know, company X is taking, you know, this amount of money from me every month, I've got to go and find a way to cancel it. It's when they start asking you to phone up and all of that kind of stuff, which is bad. It should be a one button on the internet these days to get rid of a subscription. So moves in that would be good. There's also talks about these Christmas savings clubs, which I know you touched on there, to avoid a repeat of Fair Pack, which happened in 2006, where something like over 100,000 low-income families mostly would save up for things like hampers or gifts for Christmas over the course of a year, and it went bust, and they ended up only getting half their money back, and it took a very long, drawn-out process to do that. It's to ring-fence money. And these kind of schemes are still popular. People still take part in them because, you know, it can be a good way to save for Christmas instead of splurging all in December, spreading out the costs. It's almost like a sensible thing, sounding thing to do. But it's making sure that money's safeguarded to protect those kind of things. And also for big purchases like used cars or home improvement, building work and all of that kind of stuff. We're talking about real big purchases here. It's having it mandatory for firms to have a mediation process. A better mediation process, so it doesn't get dragged through courts. I've heard all sorts of stories actually in recent months about just how busy the courts are, so I wouldn't be surprised that this is just a move to get these kind of disputes just out of the courts. You know, it's almost like wasting time at the courts, where it should be a company that's, you know, the mediation process should just be better. Again, I remember a story of a family member bought a used car from a dealership a number of years ago. And it ended up being a complete duff car, and the dealership completely washed their hands of it. And it became a real long, drawn out process that went to court and all sorts. So it's trying to stop those kind of things. But significantly, with some of this stuff, is that they're talking about big penalties. And we say this quite often. We feel like penalties, or I feel like penalties sometimes for things that go wrong, like really fundamental things that go wrong in a business, can be quite puny in terms of turnover. And you think, oh, they've been fined that much, but they're a massive company. So, you know, what does it matter to them? It's hardly anything. But they're talking about CMA being able to dish out fines of up to 10% of global turnover. Now, that's a pretty big number, depending on how big your business is. And it probably should be done on a percentage basis, because if you are a big company that's making a lot of money and you are found to be doing unscrupulous things, you should be fined. Yeah. And before I stop all this, we, of course, do ask for reviews or full of This Is Money podcast at the end of the show. And I should point that out. You know,
they're all genuine and
all genuine.
5-star, not all from my mom.
Just in case any listeners going, hold on a minute, you guys ask for reviews at the end of every podcast. That's what I should point out.
It's fair enough, Lee. That's fair enough. Let's move on to savings. Now, you might think that lack of savings is solely an issue for those on low incomes, but you would be wrong. According to a new report, close to a quarter of the UK's wealthiest households don't have enough savings to cover an emergency. Now, we're talking about those with incomes of over $100,000 a year who couldn't pay a big unexpected bill or cover their essential outgoings for 3 months using their savings. Retirees also doing worse than one would hope. Simon, tell us about this report. Rich people not saving enough.
Yes, and I think the first thing to bear in mind here is that this is a report based on people's income. And it's based on, so it's not based on their wealth itself, obviously. It's also based on their household income. So it's talking about households with an income of £100,000 a year. And that is very different to households where one person has an income of £100,000 a year. Obviously, if there's only one person with an income and there's nobody else with an income, then obviously that's £100,000, but you might have a household where there's £100,000 income and a £50,000 or £200,000 incomes or £100,000 and £98,000. So there's quite a lot of difference there. But 23% of households with an income of £100,000 a year could not pay a large unexpected bill or cover their essential outgoings for 3 months using their savings. That's pretty shocking, isn't it? Because that's a lot of money. If your household is pulling in £100,000 a year, you are way, way, way up the percentiles on household income. But it's a plausible situation because it can be that you spend what you earn. And actually for a lot of people, they spend more than they earn, even when they earn a lot. Expenses mount up. And it's not just lifestyle expenses. Now, the big one that often gets talked about is school fees. Whenever you see those features about someone who was rich and then they're down on their luck and they're really struggling to get by and all this kind of stuff, it's always the school fees. It's always the school fees that they're paying that gets them. Now, bearing in mind private school fees on average are about £15,000 a year. And most people have two kids and two of those kids are likely to be at school at the same time. That's £30,000 a year on school fees, right? Now, you've got to earn 50 to pay the 30 for most people who are going to be paying those school fees. So it's no surprise that if you're forking out on private school fees, you might find that you are a bit short on cash. The obvious solution is not to send your children to private school, or if you do suddenly find yourself struggling to take them out of the private school. However, people are understandably reluctant to move their children to schools. And that is actually quite often one of the last things that they will do. And I have read so many features over the years of people racking up huge amounts of debt because they won't move their kids out of school. I mean, obviously anybody in this situation, the first thing you should do is actually speak to the school, because often the schools will try and help out. But the vast majority of kids don't go to private school. So, so you don't have that expense. My kids don't. Thank God I don't have that expense. So where's all the money going? Well, for a lot of people living in relatively normal family homes in certain parts of the country, they might be paying £2,500-£3,000 a month on their mortgage. They might be paying even more. I mean, if they're renting the same house, they'll certainly be paying more than they would be paying on the mortgage. So once you take that into account, and then you take into account all your normal bills, your gas, your electricity, your food, shopping, and even if you're not holidaying all the time, maybe you holiday once or twice a year, and then there's quite a strong chance that in order for both people to be working, you're probably going to have to be paying for childcare as well. I mean, we pay for breakfast club and after school club so that both me and my wife can work. And we're lucky we don't even have to do that every day. But the costs really mount up. And that pales into insignificance compared to the cost of having your children in nursery. When my kids were in nursery, in a fairly nice but pretty bog standard nursery in Finsbury Park, right? Not the world's most expensive or richest place, although there are plenty of people there earning plenty of money. I was paying more money for them to be in nursery than I would have been for them to be in private school. And I tell you one thing, a nursery certainly ain't paying its staff the wages that they pay people at private school. And so you can easily see how all this money gets eaten up And then you can easily see why it becomes impossible for people to save. And so it sounds absolutely outrageous when you hear stuff like this and when you read some of these stories. And there's another stat here. Among the very wealthy who earn more than 150 grand, 12% don't have enough savings. People need 3 to 6 months worth of essential spending in an easy access account to cover emergencies. That amounts to, you know, quite a lot of money for people who are high earning. So what can you do about it? That's the question. I mean, firstly, the obvious thing is you need to cut your expenditure by as much as possible. So you need to sit down and you need to draw up a budget, and you need to be absolutely honest with yourself about how much money you're spending. Oh yeah, I forgot the other one. Lots of people pay £5,000 a year to go to work on season tickets, which is why I think there's quite a lot of reluctance among certain people in the population to go back to paying £5,000 a year to go to work rather than not paying that and staying in their houses. Anyway, so what are you going to do? Well, firstly, you can't stop. I mean, people obviously have temporarily stopped paying the money to go back to work, but they have to stop paying that. Mm-hmm. You can't do anything about that. You can't really do much about your gas and electricity bill. You can turn off the lights and turn down the heating, but in all honesty, this is not going to make a huge difference to your financial situation. You can't do anything about your mortgage, but you can do stuff about some of the other things. Do you need your expensive PCP deal car that you have? I mean, lots of people in this situation, how much are they paying every month for their car? Maybe you could not get the brand new car and you could go buy a secondhand one instead and save yourself a bit of cash. How much are you spending on things like holidays and stuff? Because the difference between going on holiday 3 times a year and 1 time a year is quite a big difference. I'm not going to suggest that people could go on holiday in the UK in order to save money, because I would be laughed out of the room on that one. but you know, do you need to be doing the big bang holidays that you're doing if you are doing big bang holidays? In terms of what you're spending, you know, the things like disposable stuff, your disposable income stuff, the going out, the eating out, the takeaways, the clothes, the stuff like that. But when you draw up this budget, do not put a red pen through every single bit of that non-essential expenditure, because you absolutely must allow yourself some money for going out for dinner or some drinks or having a takeaway or buying some clothes or maybe going on holiday. Because otherwise, for most people, unless you are a super scrimper, you are setting yourself up to fail, because you will end up spending money on that. And you'll be miserable by not doing it, and you'll end up doing it going, oh, and then all of a sudden, before you know it, you've blown the budget. So be realistic. Give yourself your essentials, give yourself a bit of money to spend on the fun stuff in life, give yourself a column on like, these are the things I could properly cut back on, and then stick at it, and maybe divide it up into weekly amounts or something like that, and try and play a game with yourself where you try to spend less than a certain amount every week. And then if you do that, then you reward yourself with a little bit extra. You got like a 20 quid in the pot as a reward every week, and every week you manage to spend less than X, you take 20 quid out of the pot as your reward, and you go treat yourself with 20 quid's worth of stuff. And then just save everything you possibly can. And I absolutely feel for anybody listening to this who hasn't got a hope of saving because their outgoings are so much larger than their incomings, or who are also really, really struggling and would dream of having a household income of £100,000 a year and don't expect to ever have that, you know, in their lifetime.
Lee, we just heard Simon talking there about people with quite hefty incomes, or households, should we say, with quite hefty incomes, not being able to save. It seems quite extraordinary as well when you think about the context of the last year, when, you know, a lot of people won't be spending lots of money on commuting and going on holiday and all that sort of thing. Are you surprised by this research?
I'm hugely surprised by this research, George. Yeah, I mean, when I saw that figure, I thought it was quite a high figure given the data that we've had and we've seen from, you know, the Bank of England over the last 12 to 18 months, the amount of people that have managed to tuck away extra amounts of money throughout the pandemic. Yes, you know, people have lost jobs and all that kind of stuff, but there are people that have kept their jobs and then have seen things like commuting costs completely dissipate. For example, you know, if you're in London and the South East, that can be £5,000 a year that could be tucked away if you've been lucky enough to work from home. And there's lots of data out as well suggesting that it's kind of kick-started savings habits, you know, and people have managed to start tucking cash away. So I am quite surprised, but for all the reasons that Simon mentioned, you know, nursery is expensive, You know, the cost of living is expensive, and the cost of living, especially if you're in cities such as London, where you know wages are high, the cost of living is incredibly high compared to other pockets of the country. So, you know, trying to keep a savings pot ticking over isn't the most simple thing to do. But I am surprised. I am really surprised at that figure. It feels very high. And if that is someone, if you are someone, regardless of your household income, I would, you know, strongly advise sitting down, formulating a plan, and figuring out how much money you can spare each month to have this kind of safety net, because you know it's a good thing to have. You don't know what's around the corner.
Sort of, it's lifestyle creep, isn't that what they call it? So when you get a pay rise, for example, or you earn a bit more, better job, you're not perhaps going to go to Lidl, you're going to go to Waitrose and that sort of thing. I made sure when I came up north and my rent was slashed in half because it's so much cheaper up here, that half went straight into a savings account. I was not going to spend it. I wasn't going to pretend that I earned any more. That was where that's gone. So there you go.
And that's
the thing I've done, I think.
And that's good, George. And actually, in a similar vein, I've just come to the point now where I've paid off my student loan. You know, I came out of university with a 25 grand student loan. I've finally reached the end of it. And the 350, 400 quid a month that I'm saving from, you know, it not going into the student loan, it's gone straight into an investment account because, you know, it's money I didn't have before and it's money that I just want to build for the future. And, you know, I think a lot of attitudes can be shaped from, you know, what you've seen as a youngster growing up. You know, my parents got into financial difficulties with their own property. They overstretched themselves. They tried to keep up with the Joneses. I saw it all unfold in front of my eyes. You know, I was 10 years old when all of that happened, and it has shaped my money habits. You know, now going forward, I don't ever want to be in that situation where, you know, I live beyond my means and don't have the right backup if things go wrong. And things can go wrong quite quickly. And that's what I think people, no matter what income you're on, because let's face it, if you're on a higher income, you've got potentially higher outgoings, and those outgoings can't necessarily just stop. So, you know, it's important for anyone on any level of money just to have some sort of pot in the background. Yes, easy access rates are rubbish, and you're not going to make a lot of money interest doing that, but at least you're going to have that safety net. And it is all about getting into that habit, as we've said time and time again.
Indeed, but it's something worth repeating, Lee. Okay, so if you are building up your savings pot, that emergency savings, where do you put the money? Well, if it's an emergency savings pot, you probably do want to keep it in an easy access account, even though the rates are rubbish. Well, let's be honest, the rates are rubbish across the board. But Lee, I always do this, don't I? The eternal optimist in me. We have three new Best Buy launches, fixed savings deals, nudging a little bit higher. Can I get excited or not?
You can get excited if you want, Georgie, but I mean, I'm going to be quite honest here. You know, as someone that has kept an eye on the savings market for, you know, the last 12 years or so, it's been very hard to get excited, regardless, even before the pandemic, but now even more so. It is tricky out there, but we have seen a little chink of light, and I like to, you know, get those little chinks of light reported on when we see them. And that is the fact that fixed rates have started to nudge a bit higher for the first time since October 2020. Average rates on all fixed accounts went up, which is a sign that things might be going in the right direction. However, the average rate has nudged up to 0.52%. Pre-pandemic, it was 1.41%. That is a huge drop in quite a short amount of time. But the thing is that this is the area that challenger banks like to compete in, right? They like to compete in the fixed rate market because they can have more control over how much is coming in, set targets, and know how much interest they're going to have to pay out after a certain amount of time. So we always see a bit more competition here than we do in easy access, which can be a lot more volatile. People taking money out, you can't really predict what people are going to do, and ISAs as well, for that matter. So it is good signs. We've seen a two-year fix come out this week at 1.25%. You can get a little bit more interest if you open it with a savings platform, Raisin, that's offering a bonus. And that comes with FSCS protection. But, you know, that requires you not touching your money for 24 months. So what we were just talking about there, about having a safety buffer and having a safety net, that's not going to be the right place for you to do that. I mean, at the start of the pandemic, I decided to open the first direct regular saving account. which is 2.75%. Well, was 2.75% when I opened the account. Saved that, maxed that out, 300 quid a month. That was money that I wasn't spending on the commute. And I thought, I've got to do something with this money. I was lucky enough to have kept my job, lucky enough to have been working from home, and lucky enough and then not having to fork out £5,000 a year on my season ticket. So I thought, this is the time to kickstart another pot of money and do something with it later on down the line. You know, it's those kind of things that it's just worth, you know, thinking about. That regular saving now pays 1% if you opened it now, and actually the rates on them have all dropped everywhere. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's about getting in the habit, and it's not always necessarily about chasing the rate.
Indeed, Lee. Very true. Very true. I feel at this point, Lee, we need to sort of fess up to the listeners that due to because we're actually going to talk about a sort of technical thing next. I feel now is the time that we say, due to a technical error, we've lost Simon. But being the troop, I mean, not lost him. I mean, he's just dropped off and won't participate in the rest of the podcast. So Lee, firstly, I'm sorry it all falls on your shoulders, but Simon, like a trooper, has allowed us to carry on for the good of the listener. So be assured Simon will return next week, but I felt I needed to say something there, Lee, in case anyone was thinking I was just going la la la, I can see you, Simon, but not going to ask you anything because don't care. I do care about Simon's opinions. He's just not here to give them. Is that fair enough, Lee?
I love it. It does. Otherwise, it did just sound like you've just cut Simon completely out. You've had enough of what he had to say, and you just thought, I'm going to Lee. Lee's talking all the sense, which
it's always the case, though, isn't it? Always the case. Yeah. If Simon had gone on a bit too much, enough of us, it, Simon. No. We are going to talk about the next story, because actually, after reading this, I checked my phone. I went to my O2 account. Other providers are available, but I just don't have them. And I checked my average data usage, and it is 4.22 gigabytes. I pay, granted not a lot, but I pay for 15. And it seems, Lee, I am not alone. Over 70% of mobile phone users are using less data than we pay for, often because, of course, we hook up to Wi-Fi at home. You know, while I think I only pay about 15 quid a month, I could still knock that down to about maybe £8 or £9, given how much I actually use. Why are we in this situation, and how much is it costing us?
This is a really interesting area, actually, Georgie, because mobile phone contracts are one of those things where actually you're paying way more for the handset than you are the data and the minutes, most likely if you get a new phone. And I think our relationship with mobile contracts needs to be reevaluated somewhat. And this kind of highlights it, I think. I had my phone for 2 years. I had it on a contract, a pay monthly contract. I came to the end of it. The phone is perfectly fine. It's 2 years old. I don't need a brand new phone. So I just went on a pay-as-you-go deal, paying something like £8 a month for rounds of data, unlimited minutes. Do you remember back in the day, you used to have to pay quite a lot for things like minutes? No one really picks up the phone anymore and speaks on the phone. You know, and all of these kind of things have really chipped away at like networks' margins. You know, they don't make as much money off of that kind of thing anymore. So there's what I would say is there's a couple of things here. If you had a phone, a brand new phone, I personally would never have more than a 2 year fixed contract. They are now starting to nudge into 3 year contracts because handsets have become quite expensive. You know, latest iPhone can cost, you know, more than £1,000 if you get a high spec one. You know, it's expensive and people like to buy it, and you know, fair enough, that's the way you want to do it. But I was actually toying potentially with getting a new phone. So this was like probably about 18 months ago now. So I've been on this for about 18 months. So the phone now is becoming more like 4 years old. And let's face it, like tech should last for quite a long time. You know, and it's a real throwaway society, I find sometimes with mobile phones. And it makes me a bit sad that people feel like they have to be on this constant loop of getting a new phone. But, you know, it's people's choice. But if we're going in this whole, let's get more environmentally friendly, probably chucking your phone away after a couple of years isn't the best bet. I had a quick look at the best mobile contracts, and then I looked at how much it was to buy the handset from the manufacturer directly, and then how much and then keeping the same monthly contract that I've got now, and then working out over 2 years, working it out over 3 years. It made way more economic sense, right? And that might be teaching people to suck eggs if you're listening to that going, you know, of course. But some people just don't think of it like that and do think they just got to go and get the new, get a new contract, you know, get to the end. You get sort of pressured into upgrading, all of that kind of stuff. I think people need to have a look and see what they're actually really spending, because I fall in the same category as you, Georgie. I don't use, well, I would say I do use a fair amount of mobile data, but nowhere near as much mobile data as I was using before the pandemic. Because the only time really I would not be on the Wi-Fi with my phone would be on the commute, right? So 40 minutes into Liverpool Street for me here and back, it's probably the only time. It may be out and about sometimes to look on Google Maps or something like that. But at home, log onto the Wi-Fi, from my work, goes onto the Wi-Fi. So, you know, that's a large chunk of my life. My mobile phone life is spent, it all hooked up to Wi-Fi, you know, and pay enough money for Wi-Fi as it is. So why am I going to be spending over the top amounts for you know, mobile data? So this research is really interesting. And actually, I think it's one of those areas that people need to have a think about and see if they can be cutting back. Because to me, I've got friends that pay 50, 60 quid a month on a mobile phone. And I've never done that personally myself. And this is not me going, oh, you know, don't get the latest phone. You know, that's up to you. It's your choice. If you feel comfortable enough. I just think there's that kind of looking how much data you're actually using compared to how much you're paying for. If you are getting a market for a new phone, how much it will cost for you to buy that new phone and get a good pay as you go deal compared to paying for it monthly, and sussing out what is the best bet for you. I think that mobile networks and companies are struggling a little bit in the terms of, it's not as like the good old days in terms of people using up lots of minutes and going over their minute plans and people going over their mobile data. Although I should point out, this week we had a story, this is money from Grace, about someone that went to Kazakhstan and ran up an £8,500 phone bill with O2 because they couldn't get Wi-Fi in the hotel and they needed it for work. So it goes to show that there are some money making opportunities for networks elsewhere. But you know,
it does seem to be where there's errors though. Exactly that.
So yeah, as I say, it's people's prerogative and people like to get the latest tech. But for me, and you might feel the same way, and listeners might feel the same way, or maybe they don't. I don't think the technology on phones has improved that much.
No.
They got really good about 6-7 years ago. You know, good cameras. They do everything you really need. Listen to music through Spotify, for example. Watch some videos. Surf social media. You know, you might watch a couple of YouTube videos. That kind of thing, most phones can just do that now. So what's the next thing? And I don't know what it is, and that's why I haven't been really thinking, oh, I'm going to go and pay big bucks for like a brand new, you know, state of the art phone.
The next thing I think is batteries. No, you're absolutely right. Every year I think that I cover a story about, you know, how we've reached smartphone peak, because I mean, obviously you're going to have the dedicated fans that want the latest, that are queuing outside the Apple store and notice all the kind of extra, you know, bits and bobs and whatnot. I don't. I'm exactly the same as you. I bought my phone outright and I pay SIM only. I think in defense of people generally, the consumer, I don't think enough is made of the idea of buying your phone outright. I mean, I look on O2 just when I was having a look there, and all of the options were how to upgrade, but how to upgrade with a contract. I'm not even on a contract. So how to upgrade with a contract. I think if we had more articles like this, more research like this, more being done to try and highlight the economic benefits perhaps of buying your phone outright and the options available to you. You might feel uncomfortable paying that sort of whack of money straight up, but there are options you can use. You can use, you know, zero purchase credit cards as long as you pay it off and use it sensibly and all those sorts of things. Or you could save up for one, because actually the money that you will save from keeping hold of your phone for 4 years and not paying that extraordinary amount of money, then, you know, it makes economic sense.
Exactly. And if you're paying £10 a month, you know, for argument's sake, compared as you go, you know, mobile phone operators hike up prices every year by, you know, RPI plus whatever percent. And this year, that's quite a high amount, you know. And if you're doing it on £10 opposed to £60, you know, it's a far lesser impact, you know, having it on that smaller amount. And you're right, not everyone can afford a phone outright. I just think you've got to have your options open. And I don't, as you say, I don't think the options are made all that clear to the consumer. So you've just got to do your homework, like a lot of this stuff. And it can be a massive outlay, George. People sometimes spend more on this than other household bills. You know, it can be very expensive. And these phones get damaged and all of that kind of stuff. It's like, you know, it's one of those industries where I like to just keep hold of my phone, batter it as much as I can, you know, it's got a couple of cracks in it, but it's fine. Totally. It works fine. Just keep hold of it and just keep going and going and going and get the absolute grain, every inch of its life out of this phone before I upgrade and get something different. But as I say, that
I'm
might
like that
just
with my
be
car.
Me.
I say no. I'm the same. I'm just wondering though, just before we move on from this, I went into O2 and I remember having a conversation with the lady in the store, and she explained to me about how they put up RPI. This was quite a few years ago, and she said if you don't want it put up, you can just ask for it not to go up. And I said, well, can I ask for it not to be put up then? And she said, yeah, sure. So she just gave me the contract without increasing. I don't know if that's still the case. And I should have found out.
Incredible.
Being a terrible personal finance journalist, I haven't found that out, because I did get a note from O2 going, it's going up. And I went, all right, that's nice.
Yeah, nice to everyone else. But I've beat the system. I've had a word with my friend down in the shop. And exactly. He sorted me out. Georgie, I'm not being funny, but sales people and sales stuff in any kind of shop.
Don't say anything.
Say anything to get you signed up. It's always in the small print. And unless you read those 300 pages of small print, where there's a clause saying if you've been told in store that it won't go up by hour, but it will, and I don't believe it. But hey, you go away and check it. I'm a cynic.
Get it. All right then. Finally, if you want a holiday this year, you don't fancy another summer of COVID disruptions, you could try a staycation in Blighty. They're blooming expensive though, and let's be honest, they're probably all booked up by now anyway. But wait, there is an alternative. It is not, however, for everybody. I keep reading about these, Lee. House swaps. Are they as popular as I'm being led to believe, or is this just a really amazing PR department at one of the house swapping companies that I keep reading articles about house swapping? Because this was something you used to do when you went abroad, but I guess the popularity is now we're seeing more of this happen within our own country.
I don't believe that this is really a big thing. I think it's one of those things that people have a romantic notion about. You know, they've watched A Holiday with Jude Law, where they swap houses between, you know, Britain, you know, little chocolate box village to like some absolute swanky pad out in the States. And they've seen that and thought, well, that sounds like quite a good idea. But it's one of those things where it does take a lot to take the plunge, because your home is your castle, and, you know, you don't want it to fall into hands of someone that's going to come and, you know, trash the place or not treat it respectfully. So all I would say with this kind of thing is that if you are interested in this, we thought about it this summer, Georgie, you know, prices of holidaying in Britain are expensive and they've gone through the roof. We just had a week in Norfolk. We went to North Norfolk last week. Glad I packed my coat. It was cold. And stayed in the house. And it was as expensive as it would have been to have a week, you know, somewhere hot and exotic. You know, it's not cheap to holiday in this country. And actually, if the person who owned that property wanted to swap that with my three-bed house out here in Essex, then fine, yeah, I'll be all for it. But, you know, most of us live in sort of, you know, pockets of unless you've got a house that's really fit for this, you know, you're kind of excluded, and that's quite a large chunk, I would suggest, of the country. No one's going to want to come and stay in my house here and swap it for somewhere, but there is one person that would, and we almost did it, and that was my wife's auntie. So she lives out in Jersey. She's got family obviously here and around here, and we toyed up with asking to do a swap with her, so she didn't have to come here and pay for a hotel. We'd go to Jersey and we wouldn't have to pay for a hotel, and hotels in Jersey are expensive anyway. But then in the end, I just decided it wasn't worth it, because not that I don't trust Danielle's auntie, but it would take a day to get the house straight, get it all tidied, get it. And then thinking about, you know, how, making sure it's absolutely clean to the umpteenth degree and all that kind of stuff. And then I'm starting to think, oh, I'm going to need another holiday off the back of that holiday. And I reckon quite a lot of people might think like that. But if you are tempted, I would definitely say, you know, you test it with a friend or a family member or a friend of a friend first, someone that you really trust. Or if you're going to use one of these websites, so some of these companies, there's Homelink UK, Love Home Swap, Home Exchange, get to know the person, you know, really well. And I mean, you know, Zoom calls, telephone calls, you know, not to make it completely like over the top, but just to make sure this is someone that's going to be a good fit. And it takes a bit of luck, do you think, Georgie? Like, if you wanted to go to Devon, or Cornwall, what are the chances are that someone's going to come to Skipton? You know, it's like there's that kind of, you have to get it at the right plumb point, I guess, and hope for the best and hope that someone's got somewhere that you want. But anyone that's got a property like that, usually it's going to be like a holiday home or a second home that they're going to have on somewhere like Airbnb or a specialist cottage company or something like that. So it's hard to get it over the line, I would suggest. But I'd love to hear from anyone that has done this, because the concept's great. because it's low cost. It costs like, you know, 100 and so quid to be part of one of these websites. You can get insurance for your home, specialist insurance that bolts on top of your existing household insurance for as little as £1.50 a day. I would check with your mortgage lender, I would check with your insurer, all of that kind of stuff before you take the plunge. But these websites must be awash with this information, otherwise they wouldn't exist. And it can be a way, potentially, I suppose, of saving quite a bit of cash. But you just have to have a home that's attractive for someone that wants to swap. And I would suggest a large chunk of people don't.
Or can't be bothered to get it in a state where it would be attractive for someone to swap.
Exactly.
I don't know. Look, I'm not precious about my home, probably because I don't own it. And I probably couldn't do this anyway because I rent. But, you know, be that as it may. I think I'd just be concerned during the trip that I'm away that they would need... Because you have to be on call, don't you, essentially, for them should something go wrong. So while you're trying to enjoy your holiday in their home and they're trying to enjoy their holiday in your home, if something goes wrong, you have to be on the end of the phone sorting things out, blah blah blah. That to me would just be a stress, and I'd be worried about my home as well, even though I'm not precious about it. Anyway, but yeah, like Lee said, if it's you've done it, let us know. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee,
you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us @thisismoney, and you can comment in the article where this podcast will live, and you can let us know if you've done some home swapping or if you've been leaving some nice reviews dotted around the internet. Get involved.
Excellent. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.